And good morning to counsel for our fourth oral argument this morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. While you're getting settled in, I'll call the case. It is Anthony Kelly versus the Burnix Company et al. Case number A220599. And today's November 9th, 2022. As I noted, this is the last oral argument scheduled today. We are making a recording of the arguments that you'll be presenting this morning. And so before you begin, I just ask that you identify yourselves and the party or parties you're representing. Please present your arguments from the center podium, as that's where we're recording you. As you both know, appellant will have 15 minutes to present. Respondent will then have 15 minutes, and appellant will have a five-minute rebuttal. And I don't want to have you go before you're ready. Are you both settled in and ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm representing the Burnix Company and the other appellants in this case. Burnix is entitled to judgment as a matter of law because plaintiff failed to establish the crucial element of causation. To establish liability, a plaintiff must prove a direct causal link between a defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injuries. Here, however, the district court ruled that plaintiff's evidence, and I quote, did not establish a direct causal link between the speed and the reaction of the hose. That's addendum page 8. Plaintiff doesn't dispute that finding on appeal. Based on that district court ruling that there was no direct causal link between the speed of the truck, which is the basis of plaintiff's negligence claim, and the reaction of the hose, which is what caused the accident and therefore the injuries, the district court erred in submitting the case to the jury and in denying JMOL in favor of Burnix Company. The district court's ruling that there was no establishment of a direct causal link was correct. The physics of the interplay between the speed and the fluid dynamics and the hose was not within the general knowledge of the public, and that's why plaintiffs offered experts, both a trucking expert and a physics expert, to testify. But that expert testimony did not provide the required causal link. None of plaintiff's experts said, here's how the accident happened. None of them said, this is how the accident could have happened. None of them said that the accident wouldn't have happened if the truck had been going more slowly. None of them examined or considered any alternative causes of the accident. The experts just said, here are some general principles of physics that might have permitted the accident to have happened under certain circumstances. That's not sufficient to establish causation, and that's what the district court recognized in its ruling.
So, counsel, can I ask you to go further along on the district court's analysis at the addendum at page 8? You quoted the part about the district court saying that Dr., and I don't say his name correctly, I'm sorry, you might know how to say it.
Zajewski?
Yeah, there you go. His testimony at trial did not establish a direct causal link between the speed and the reaction of the hose. But then the district court goes on to say the evidence supported that the reaction of the hose was unpredictable. As to speed, expert testimony was not necessary for the concept that at a higher speed, the rear axle of the truck will traverse a distance at a faster rate. And then the district court goes on beyond that. So it seems to me the district court rejects the premise you're asking us to accept, and I just want you to explore that with us a bit.
Certainly. The district court, it's a little confusing because that comment follows immediately the statement that there's no direct causal link. But
in expert testimony, and then the district court says it was necessary for the expert to prove that point, and it created a jury.
Right.
What it says. You read it.
Correct.
So.
And says that at a higher speed, the rear axle of the truck will traverse a distance at a faster rate. Basically, that the rear axle is going the same speed mm-hmm. as the truck, which is, as the district court knows, common sense. But that alone is not enough to establish causation. It doesn't establish, number one, how fast the truck would have to be going in order to cause the hose to jump. Number two, that the hose would have jumped in fact, up to a foot, which is the distance their expert testified it was required to reach to become entangled with the rear axle.
Well, we know, in fact, it did become entangled with
the... We know it became entangled with the rear axle, but we don't know that that happened because of the speed, which is the source of the negligence here, which is, the source of the negligence. It also doesn't...
We do know that it jumped.
I beg your pardon?
I mean, what they wanted the expert testimony, I mean, how I've understood it is the district court wasn't going to let the testimony come in that the speed affected whether or not the hose jumped, but we do know that the hose jumped.
We know the hose became entangled somehow. We don't know that it jumped because of this increase in pressure, because none of their experts said that that's why it jumped. Or that they said that, number one, they didn't say that it jumped, and number two, they didn't say that that's why it jumped. In fact, they did experiments. I'm sorry, you have a question.
Oh, I mean, but jurors could infer that the hose was on the ground and then somehow was not on the ground in order for it to get entangled.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
But there was no proof as to, no expert testimony as to how that happened. Nobody testified that it actually jumped. In fact, their plaintiff's expert did experiments trying to make it jump and was unable, in all the experiments, it only jumped once, and the one time it did jump was at 40 miles an hour, which is higher than even plaintiff claims the truck was possibly moving here. So that's the gap that's missing. I mean, it was plaintiff's burden to prove that the accident happened the way that he posits it happened.
Well, sometimes proof is established through direct evidence, and sometimes proof is established through circumstantial evidence. It sounds to me like the district court was saying that, you know, there may not have been direct evidence, but there certainly was enough for a jury to make the inference, enough circumstantial evidence to support that inference. Should that affect the review that this court does?
Several responses to that. First of all, Your Honor, the district court was commenting just on speed here. It wasn't talking about the mechanism of the jump. It wasn't talking about how high the hose would have to jump, how long it would have to stay at that height in order to become entangled, according to plaintiff's argument. So even assuming what you're talking about was a reasonable inference for a layperson to make, it's still only related to the speed and not to the other steps necessary for causation. But second, there's a difference between the district court didn't say there is no direct evidence of a causal link. The district court said there is no evidence of a direct causal link. And this is why the cases that plaintiff cites
Mr. Jones, one more time. Actually, the district court focused just on the testimony of the one expert when that comment was made. The district court was not talking about the record as a whole. I mean, there's another sentence I'm missing, but the one at the addendum at page 8 is specifically about... Oh, and you say it better than I do, but this Dr. Z's testimony. So, I mean, it is limited. It seems to me you're making too much out of that and not looking at the record as a whole.
Right. Dr. Zajewski's testimony at trial did not establish a direct causal link between speed and the reaction of the hose, but nothing else did either. And that's something that would require expert testimony to understand the physical relationship. I mean, that's not something that a lay juror or even a lay attorney would be able to calculate and figure out what the fluid dynamics were. And so by saying that Dr. Zajewski did not establish that direct causal link, the court was essentially saying that causal link was not established because expert testimony was necessary. Whatever you can make, whatever inference you can make from circumstantial evidence as a lay person about the speed of the rear axle compared to the speed of the truck, which is the comment you mentioned earlier, you still don't have enough expert testimony to get to the conclusion that there was causation. The cases that plaintiffs cite in their brief, the Maharis, Schaub, and McCarthy cases, those are all cases that deal with the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. They say, okay, if someone falls from the top of a stairway, do you need someone to see them fall to be able to infer that the defective condition of the stairs was sufficient to cause the accident? That's a different question than what we have here. We're not talking about whether or not there's direct or circumstantial evidence of a causal link. We're talking about whether or not there is evidence at all, direct or circumstantial, of the direct causal link that's required to establish causation here.
So is it your position that expert testimony was necessarily required in this case? I mean, what if the plaintiffs had presented no expert testimony? Would their case necessarily fall on causation? I guess I just asked the same question two different ways.
No, it's absolutely. The need for expert testimony here is critical. I mean, you have to, there are certainly circumstances where you can say that if a part, in a traffic accident case, that if there was negligence, that negligence clearly without expert testimony caused the injury. Here, you don't have that. Here, you know there was an accident, and we're not disputing negligence for the purpose of this, but there has to be some kind of connection between the two. It has to be the negligence that caused the injuries, and not just the conduct, the accident itself. And here, the Minnesota Supreme Court put it in the Stahlberg case, where questions involve obscure and abstruse medical factors, such that the ordinary layman cannot reasonably possess well-founded knowledge of the matter and could only indulge in speculation in making a finding. There must be expert testimony based on adequate factual foundation that the thing alleged to have caused the result not only might have done so, but in fact did cause it.
I understand in the context of a medical case, medical negligence is something that is really not within the purview of an ordinary juror, but sort of general physics principles, I think, as the district court suggested, are different in quality than the sort of information underlying a medical negligence action.
But when you have something that is technical here, I mean, there's no question that the accident caused Mr. Kelly's injuries. There's no question about that. The question is, did the negligence, in other words, the supposed speed of the truck, cause that injury? Would the injury still have happened had the truck run over the hose at a slower speed? That was what the plaintiff's burden was. They needed to prove proximate cause, that is, direct cause, and they needed to prove the but-for. And their experts, they didn't do that. That's not something that a lay person is able to determine. It requires calculation, as plaintiff offered, of the speed of the truck, the distance that a hose will go up, the length of time it will stay elevated. That's what a lay person wouldn't be able to calculate. The connection
but isn't between there expert testimony on the amount of time that the hose would stay in the air and what speed the truck would need to drive in order to get the distance from the front of the truck to the rear axle? I mean, that testimony did come in at trial.
There was testimony about how high the hose could jump, and that was not speed dependent. The problem was nobody ever said it jumped that high here. This actually happened. This is a theory that I have, and this is what actually happened here. They didn't even say it could have happened here. And as I mentioned before, the testing they did was only able to make the hose jump once at 40 miles an hour, and even that jump was not high enough that it would have entangled with the rear axle. They couldn't duplicate what they said had happened, and none of the experts at trial actually said, this is what happened. This is what caused the accident.
So what is the test, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
What is the testimony that you think would have need to have been elicited in order to have met this direct causation, direct causal link?
If one of their experts had said, I am testifying to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that a truck running over a hose at 30 miles an hour would cause it to jump more than a foot in the air and stay there for 0.5 seconds or however long it would take based on the speed of the truck, the 44 feet per second, that actually happened here. That's if that were the expert's scientific belief, if that was what they had testified, that would be sufficient to establish a jury question on the issue of causation. But they didn't do that. They didn't say this is what happened. They didn't even say this is what could have happened. Their experiments don't support their theory of how the accident actually occurred, and therefore can't connect it to the negligence claimed in terms of the speed.
It seems to me that there are sort of two types of causation at issue here. There's the hose jumping, you know, speed getting entangled, but then there's also the argument that if the truck had been going slower, the injuries wouldn't have happened because the driver would have, you know, realized sooner that there was the entanglement problem, and the, you know, the injuries wouldn't have happened, or certainly wouldn't have been so dramatic. I'd like you to address that, if you
certainly
if
they,
you
they do make that argument. With respect to attentiveness, up to the time when the truck ran over the hose, it's the same thing as speed, because the only thing that would have happened earlier than that would have been to slow down. Once it ran over the hose, once again, they're missing the critical element of causation. There is no evidence of causation that, there's no testimony that would support a finding that Mr. Steinbach, the driver, could have done anything or would have been in a position to notice anything was amiss until he felt the tug when the hose remained taut and then pulled loose. Nothing suggests, I mean, as I mentioned in the brief, he was sitting in the driver's seat of a large box truck. The entanglement of the hose occurred at the, may I finish the answer?
Yes, you may.
Occurred at the back right of the truck, under the wheel back there. There's no indication, there's no testimony, either expert from plaintiff's trucking expert or from Mr. Steinbach himself, that he was in any position to see anything that could have happened, that happened there, and to slow down. And then the second step of that is, even if he had noticed it, there's no testimony that the time would have been sufficient for him to actually stop and prevent the accident from happening. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes to talk more on rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Anthony Kelly. Respondent requests that this court deny appellant judgment as a matter of law and a new trial and affirm the judgment. As the jury was instructed, a negligent act is a direct or proximate cause of harm if the act had a substantial part in bringing about the injury. And this issue of proximate cause, as this court is well aware, has been repeatedly held to be a question for the jury. And a causal connection between the negligence and the harm, if fairly and reasonably inferable from the facts and circumstances disclosed by the evidence, is sufficient to establish proximate cause. The jury, based on the evidence before it, concluded that appellant's driver was negligent, that it was causal of the harm to Mr. Kelly, and apportioned 70% of the fault on appellant. The trial court rejected appellant's argument of no causation post-trial, denied judgment as a matter of law, and denied a new trial. Now, I think it's important what the standard is for this court. As the Minnesota Supreme Court explained in Pultet at 582 Northwest 2nd at 224, in reversing this court's of a grant of judgment as a matter of law when the trial court had denied it, the Supreme Court said that on appellate review, unless the evidence is practically conclusive against the verdict, the court is not to set aside the verdict. The evidence must be viewed in a light most favorable to the verdict, and the evidence must be considered in a light most favorable to the prevailing party, and appellate court must not set aside of the verdict if it can be sustained on any reasonable theory of the evidence. Now, we know the jury was free to draw all kinds of inferences from the facts and circumstances shown. The jury was instructed, you may decide what testimony to believe and what not to believe. And the jury was instructed, in addition, you should rely upon your own experience, good judgment, and common sense. Here, the evidence was sufficient to justify the jury in finding that appellant was negligent in failing to recognize and react appropriately to the danger posed by the hose, and to then stop in sufficient time to prevent the injuries. As the trial court stated in denying denying judgment as a matter of law, and that's the last paragraph at the bottom of Addendum 8, that the jury could properly conclude that the evidence of if Steinbach had driven very slowly over the hose and had been attentive to the hose's response in relation to his vehicle as he drove over it, the injuries would not have occurred. The facts of record are that Steinbach was not attentive. He did not control his speed when he entered the work site, and as a result, we have the injury that occurred. Now, I think it's important to point out that appellant's driver, he's a commercial truck driver. He entered what he recognized to be a work zone with a large commercial vehicle, and he did so without slowing down. He knew that reduced speed was important because of the weight and size of the vehicle and the stopping distance of the large vehicle. And commercial trucking expert Herbert explained to the jury that reasonable conduct by a commercial driver was to be hyper-cautious and proceed at minimal speed when you are going over a hose and pay close attention to the what happens as you go over the hose, so if there's any disturbance in the hose, you can have time to stop. If the hose becomes entangled and you're paying attention, you can stop before you cause further harm. And he explained it's the same situation if you've got a hose down below as if you have a power line and you have a commercial truck coming through. The commercial truck driver can't just barrel through and hope, you know, gee, nothing's going to happen if I get entangled in it. But instead, you have to go very slow. Watch what's happening as you're going under that line, because if for some reason you do get entangled in it, you can stop quickly without any harm occurring. So that's what the jury heard. But what the jury also heard is that appellant's driver didn't slow down, even though he knew he was supposed to reduce his speed in work zones, and he knew it was very important because he knew there were workers there. He also knew that foreign objects on the road are a hazard. When appellant's driver saw the hose in the road, he knew it was actually part of the equipment that was presently being used by the workers on the scene. So this wasn't just a hose that was strung out there. It was actually presently being used, and he knew that. And he admitted it's important to slow down because he didn't know what the hose would do. He admitted that if he had slowed down and if there was a problem, he could stop quickly. But he didn't slow down. He didn't look to see what was happening when he drove over the hose, even though he knew something could go wrong, and as a result, Mr. Kelly was seriously injured. Based on that evidence, and any inferences that the jury can make from the evidence, that clearly is sufficient to sustain the jury's determination that the negligence was causal. Now, if we want to go over to the whole evidence of negligent speed causing entanglement, there really isn't any need to do that for this court, but it is another theory which and there was evidence to support that the jury could find negligence and that it was causal. Now, if you look at the evidence, what happened is Dr. Szczuski, everybody was calling him Dr. Z, and I understand why. They could find that negligent speed caused entanglement. So we have Dr. Szczuski, who testified. He looked at the physical evidence. He testified that for the entanglement to occur, the hose had to be elevated when the rear axle came upon it. And that's at page 7701 of the transcript. The focus then was on the front tires, specifically only the front axle, creating the pressure wave causing the hose to jump, which the rear axle then catches. And he said the hose jump is 0.3 to 0.4 seconds. And that came in also without objection. Okay, So then we have the accident reconstructionist, Mr. Graves, testifying that Steinbach was driving up to 36.4 miles per hour. And the jury was also given the distance between the front and rear axle is just over 21 feet. So if you look at the calculation that's in our brief, page 17, footnote 7, clearly the jury can conclude on that theory as well. There's evidence to support that excessive speed led to the entanglement and to the respondent's injuries. So, I mean, the trial court clearly sat through the trial, understood what was presented, and properly denied the motion for judgment as a matter of law and also for a new trial. With regard to the issue of a new trial on the issue of misconduct of counsel, again, we have the situation where we have the trial court who was in the best position to decide that issue. Now, if you look at the reply brief of the appellant likes to zero in a few statements made in closing, most of what occurred at the beginning of the closing and were without objection. Now, why it's important to kind of defer to the trial court here is because the trial court heard everything. An appellant ignores the guts of respondent's closing argument, which follows right after the statements that they're now complaining about, and I'm referring to page 2123 of the transcript, where respondent argues to the jury, so how do you guys do your job? And goes on, what are you going to do? You're going to answer the questions on the form called the verdict form. And to do so, respondent's counsel told the jury, you do that by relying on two things. The actual evidence that you've heard during these days of testimony, right? And the jury instructions. Those instructions, those are the rules. Appellant did not made one objection to the closing argument, and that was at the tail end on the golden rule objection, and that was sustained. Now, the jury was instructed to base its decision on the evidence heard in the courtroom. The jury was instructed that nothing the attorney says was evidence. And what's interesting, the jury was specifically instructed after the closing that you must not allow sympathy, prejudice, or emotion to influence your verdict. And the jury was also told that a just and proper verdict contributes to the administration of justice. Now, the appellate court will always presume that the juries follow the instructions that are given. Now, what's interesting is at the end, after the closing argument and after these instructions were given, the trial court twice asked counsel, is there anything else? Is there anything else you want to make a record of? Nothing. There was no objection further to the closing argument. There was no motion for a mistrial. So what we have here is the trial court, when it was presented with objections to the testimony, made rulings, some for the appellant, some against the appellant, made rulings when other objections were made. But here we have a situation where the trial court determined that the evidence supports the verdict, that there was no prejudice by anything that respondent's counsel might or might not have done, and that the instructions given to the jury were appropriate. When you have those three things, this court has said that there is really no basis to overrule the trial court's denial of a new trial on an abuse of discretion standard. It's not the Wild versus Rarig situation, which is if you look at the briefs of Wild versus Rarig, and we gave the cite to the court, I mean, it is the extreme. I mean, and it was the Supreme Court said it was both counsel. But this is nothing like that. The trial judge was there. The trial judge considered all of their arguments post-trial and concluded there was no basis for a new trial, and I ask that this court affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address three points quickly in my rebuttal. First, in all the discussion that you just heard from Ms. Hunt about how, about the issue of causation, there was no description of any evidence that actually suggested how the accident actually happened, how it physically happened when plaintiff's own experts couldn't duplicate it, when there is no evidence that the hose actually jumped that high or that it stayed that high long enough to become entangled. There was no consideration of any possible alternative causes. There was nothing in the evidence she cited that talked about that where any expert actually said, here is how the accident happened. Here are the physics of it. Here's what happened when the truck ran over the hose, and here's how it became entangled. It's just not there, and that's what they need for causation. Second, counsel said that cited Dr. Zajewski for the proposition that saying somehow that the negligent speed caused the entanglement. I think if you look back at the testimony that both parties have cited, you'll find that that's not the case. She cited this opinion from their accident reconstruction expert, Mr. Gravison, that the truck was going between 29.9 and 36.4 miles per hour. And from that, she extrapolates to the idea that the jury could find that it was going 36.4 miles per hour. But that's not the case. A jury can't find beyond to a preponderance of the evidence a fact that the expert on whose testimony they were relying was not that certain of. Mr. Gravison made an estimate between 29.9 and 36.4. That's a range. There is no basis for the jury to be more precise than the expert could be. Then finally, to address the question of the new trial based on attorney misconduct. What the Rarig case said was, in Rarig, there were just the kind of circumstances that were just described. There were some objections that were made. There were some objections that weren't made. There were sometimes objections that were sustained. There were sometimes instructions given. Nevertheless, the court said, some prejudicial statements were not objected to, and the trial court sustained the objections made to some of the others, and in some instances gave a cautionary instruction to the jury. Nevertheless, it is this court's responsibility to grant a new trial where misconduct, whether of party or of counsel, viewed in the light of the whole record, appears to be inexcusable and of such serious and prejudicial consequence as to deny the litigants a fair trial. I submit that the evidence shows that's what happened here. Counsel said that this was not extreme behavior. I disagree. No reasonable attorney could believe that he could properly tell a jury about a contingent fee agreement, that he could properly tell the jury about the defendant's insurance.
Didn't that happen during voir dire, though?
It did.
And wasn't the defense offered the opportunity to have a new jury twice?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, at that point in the trial, in the middle of the COVID epidemic, we didn't want to delay things even further. We assumed that counsel would comply with the judge's admonitions and temper his behavior as the trial went forward. As it turned out, that wasn't the case. But you're right, that did happen. We were offered a new jury at the beginning. But the egregious conduct continued. As I mentioned, the insurance mentioned, the repeating, accusing our expert of lying, objection sustained, accusing him again. In the very next question, these are not accidental infractions. These are conscious strategies. And we submit that they are so egregious and the court should exercise both in terms of assuring these parties a fair trial and in terms of admonishing counsel with respect to behavior that has clearly crossed the line and was intended to cross the line. In this court's supervisory role, there's got to be some consequence for that kind of misconduct. And we urge the court to grant a new trial as a consequence in this case. Unless there are further questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. This ends our oral argument calendar for the morning. We will now convene to address our non-oral cases. Thank you all.